Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery on Round Rock, where we talk about games, comics, and other stuff on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And let's go to the show for this week. This is the Roguecast for Wednesday, January 28th. And we'll start off, as always, with our quick rundown of upcoming events.
Yep.
We've got Ladies Night coming up. Going to be at Outback Steakhouse this month.
Or I think that's their
next month, technically.
Right. This is probably going to be their new location. Is that right?
Yes. At least we'll see if it sticks, but that's the plan.
Yeah. They got yummy food there.
And that is on February 9th. And that is going to be at 7 o'clock, as usual. Then that next night, the 10th, will be at BJ's Brewhouse. We're going to do Reading with Rogues. And this month's is Alex plus Ada.
Yep.
For our Valentine's Day themed.
Yes.
Because it's a robot romance, sort of.
Yeah. I think it'll be fitting.
We all like that book. You can still get that for 15% off. Then there is Gaming with Rogues on Monday the 16th, also at BJ's Brewhouse. And this time we're doing the cooperative game Pandemic, which we all love.
Yes.
Finally, February, in about a week, a little less than a week, I guess, we will be doing, February 2nd starts our annual inventory sale. We'll be clearing out some,
That sigh you hear from me is just because you said inventory.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah, there's this, we'll be closed the first Monday in March.
Out. It's right. A little ways out.
Inventory is sale is just the harbinger.
Yeah.
We've got a few weeks.
We get a month of selling stuff, and then we all close for a day, and we all come in here and stay the entire day and count everything we have in the store.
It's a little mind-numbing, but, you know, it's not, we're good at it.
It's not bad. We've figured it out.
We're gonna die.
There's always one naysayer.
And but the February sale, basically it starts at 35% off, and then you also roll two dice to get a bonus discount.
People have always liked the bonus damage discount.
Yeah,
and it's fun to do.
And there'll be a ton of stuff. We just started pulling stuff. There's a ton of good indie graphic novels. Makes us sad to sell them away, but they haven't sold in a couple of years, so a good time to check in on stuff.
Yeah, and you know what? Especially I think among the management, you can probably ask us, hey, what are the best things in here? And we're going to be able to point you to some pretty good stuff.
We will find you the gems. All right, so that's all our house cleaning stuff. There's been some news going on.
Yes.
Specifically today, as we record this.
There's casting stuff and movie trailer stuff and all sorts of things.
Well, let's talk about the movie trailer.
Okay.
Fantastic Four.
This is our teaser trailer, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a little minute long, maybe two.
Yeah. This movie, prior to this, it has been getting... pilloried would be the only word I can think of.
People do not seem to be fond of the concept.
No. So it's the director of, what was the movie?
Chronicle.
Josh Trank.
Which was like a found footage sort of superhero tragedy.
Which I know Randy and I were fond of.
Everybody at this table liked, except for Dave, liked it less.
Right. I liked it okay.
Yeah.
But I think when we heard he was doing the FF movie, before any reports came out, we were like, oh, this could work.
Yeah. It could be interesting.
But and then the more we heard, the more it sounded like it was like he so took it in his own direction that it was like almost FF in name only.
Basically not the FF,
It was more Chronicle 2 than it was a Fantastic Four movie.
Right.
Right. And having now seen the trailer, I've been skeptical about this too, and I'm still skeptical, but the trailer looks okay. It's not going to be a Fantastic Four movie. It's going to be ultimate FF at best.
Right. That is to say a sci-fi spin on the characters.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, say, the movie The Incredibles,
yeah.
that was basically the Fantastic,
that was Fantastic Four.
Yeah. You know, it had the larger-than-life stuff, the heart and the family. Now, I'll say this. The trailer for FF, it did sort of sell a strong emotional content.
Yeah.
It had sort of... both the Christopher Nolan, like, specifically that feel of Interstellar, that, like, you know, humanity trying to aspire to be something better, and the sense of a tragedy that kind of comes out of it. And they're definitely kind of running with the notion, it looks like, that their powers are not some let's-go-be-fun-explorers gift, but it's probably going to be somewhat tragic to them.
Yeah.
Because it has a sort of serious... kind of darker feel to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does. Both in sort of just tone and, you know, the music definitely kind of gives it that as well.
Absolutely.
But
I thought it looked well done, and it looked like it might have some heart and everything. So.
Well, I was surprised. Kate Mara looks pretty good as Sue.
Yeah.
I thought she looked fine.
I have no problem with the casting.
She's been in a bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
I have no problem with any of the casting.
I wasn't sure about their Reed Richards and their thing, because their thing guy looks just kind of skinny for Ben Grimm.
Yeah.
But it looks like it's going to work. And their guy for Reed looks solid, so
He's very young. In the clips I saw, was that supposed to be showing him before they did the experiment?
Well, they show him as a kid.
Yeah, right. But even the next one I saw, I was like, he looks like almost like a teenager.
Well, he's younger than Sue. in this. That's sort of a weird thing. Like, notably
very,
younger.
You know, that is a very Ultimate Universe thing.
Yeah.
You know, I'll say this. When Warren Ellis wrote Ultimate FF, that was a run I really liked, actually. I liked his sci-fi spin on it. So I am interested enough. I will consider it if it gets good reviews.
Yeah, that's about where I am. I'm of two minds. One is that I would like it to be good, just because, you know, it's always good to have more good, weird, different superhero movies. But mostly I'd like it to fail hard so that Fox will sell the FF back to Marvel.
Well, considering they've already solicited a number two for this movie.
Have they really?
Yeah.
Oh. They always do that, and then if it tanks, that'll go away.
I don't think they want to let go of this. Just they don't want to see Marvel.
Yeah, if they keep losing money, they'll let go of it.
We'll see. You know, I will say, Marvel has done a fantastic job, but I don't need everything to be that exact same speed, and I would not mind an occasional exception to it. So
I don't either. I don't
kind of root same for the speed movie. As you sort of you don't want
as
sort of
as the Marvel cinematic, as Marvel cinematic, which it is an amazing style, but it is a sort of house style. Even within it's got variety, but you know there's a certain feel, and it would not encompass this.
Yeah,
and
you're right.
Kind of like I could be interested in this as a superhero movie that is, you know, just as the X-Men movies. I like those movies, and it's certainly not what Marvel Cinematic would have done with them.
No.
But I like them as that for what they were.
Agreed. Yeah. I don't mind them having other stuff. I don't mind X-Men being off in its own universe.
You are wholeheartedly enamored of Marvel.
I am wholeheartedly. And the thing is, the Fantastic Four is so crucial to the Marvel Universe that it feels bad not having them in there. I miss the Thing. I miss the Human Torch.
Yeah. You know what's funny about those? Those characters are very larger than life, and I wonder how... Yeah, Marvel Cinematic could probably pull it off, but, you know, the Thing is basically kind of an exuberant test pilot. Johnny's a hothead. You know, I guess you could pull it off.
You could absolutely do it.
Especially, by the way, now that they've opened up the sci-fi universe stuff, you could have Reed out there charting, like, the negative zone and stuff.
And Captain America opened up the floodgates, and so did Agent Carter to do period pieces, so you could do the Fantastic Four in the 60s.
That's true.
So I think you could do some great stuff. I would love to see Reed Richards and Hank Pym and... all the science bros together too. So I would love to see it back in Marvel. I don't think it's going to happen, but that's probably my biggest complaint about it. Now that I see it and I'm like, okay, what this looks like to me is a pre-Marvel cinematic take on a movie. It looks like the early X-Men where they were embarrassed about costumes and they didn't want to sort of say they were superheroes. So they had to be like scientific heroes and that kind of thing. But the trailer looked more interesting than I would have guessed. Cause I've been pretty dead set against this.
So we shall see.
We shall see. Speaking of stuff that we're speculating on, the Battleworld map came out. After last week's press conference, I think we were sort of like in the...
Well, we should say what Battleworld is.
Battleworld is Secret Wars. People know that, right?
I don't know.
Okay.
I think at this point it's pretty...
This is Marvel's big event that we talked about last week, and Battleworld is the location of it, where these worlds will fuse or something.
Well, what I was going to say is last week we talked about the Secret Wars, and it was at the point of view of we had just heard the press conference, we didn't know a whole lot.
Right.
This we don't know
and
a
we
ton
still don't know
more.
Ton.
And I think we were all generally a little bit skeptical. We were interested but skeptical. And I know that at least for me and Nick, having seen the Battleworld map and all that kind of stuff, I've gotten a lot more enthused for it.
So they have, like, is this on Marvel's website? There's, like, an interactive map.
Yes.
Marvel.com.
It is on Marvel.com. And then...
it's under the Secret Wars heading.
And then over at Comics Alliance, if you go to there's an article called Battleworld, Deciphering the Theme Park Map of the Post-Marvel Universe. Marvel Universe. And I'll put that link in our show notes. And it is Andrew Wheeler, one of the two guys in charge over there, sort of breaking down what he believes all these things to be.
Right.
Because
that's a great breakdown.
There are 30 some zones. Oh, there are 40 zones.
Yep. Right.
And
some we don't know exactly what they are.
Some of them are classified.
Some are classified. Some we just have a title so far because Marvel doesn't want to release information on every single one of them.
But he goes through and sort of speculates, and I think he's wrong on some of it, but I think he's right on a lot of it.
But if he's right on some of it, I mean, some of the weirder ones, like, what was the Egypt one?
Egyptia,
from, like, a three-issue mini?
Yeah, New Warriors mini, or New Warriors
story. Is that an actual name that's on the map?
Yeah. Egyptia is a name that's on the map. And I don't know what else it could be, although it could be something else we don't know.
But it could be, like, Ramatut, from...
Could be. Kang's Although, past. That would be even more obscure at this point than...
I mean, Apocalypse has
his own... Well, no, like, Ramatut, though, is... And Apocalypse is the best-known sort of Egyptian.
But Apocalypse has his own land.
He has the Age of Apocalypse world.
Yeah. So. Ramatut, I believe, has not been referenced for, like, 20 or 25 years.
And we... By the way, we still don't know how these worlds will... I mean, these worlds, these locales will interact.
No, we don't. We can guess.
Other than there's going to be some sort of war, but...
Well,
there...
What Marvel is also doing is they're releasing. They've released a couple of like subtitles for books.
There's gonna be three, right?
There's gonna be a total of three. One is Last Days, which is they've described as sort of what if whatever hero that book is sort of focusing on realizes this is his final days. Like,
yeah.
What does
sort
he
like
do?
Like they did Punisher the end and Hulk the end and stuff like that.
Maybe sort of. We
not like
quite...
not like apocalyptic like those.
No,
though.
But I mean they realize that Battleworld. I have no idea. They haven't
their
sort of extrapolated
final
upon
moments.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then the second one is just titled Battle World, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, and I think that's going to be sort of
and
what's
that,
going on
and
in the world.
They've decided that that is how all of these worlds interconnect, how they act with one another, and sort of that interconnectivity to it. And they haven't released the third one yet. They're holding that.
And these are basically these will be like sort of ancillary titles
it
to
will
the
be like,
core Secret Wars
it will
miniseries.
Be like Magneto Last Days or...
It sounds like most of the ongoing books are going to get one of these three titles.
Right.
Yeah.
So it might be like Miss Marvel is Last Days, Miss Marvel, and that she'll be dealing with that. And you know, basically that sounds like it. We don't know. We're speculating on all of this.
Yeah.
But that's
I mean,
the
we
guess.
Know that these titles exist, so
related comic stuff, there was a hashtag started by Jim Zub, the guy who's wrote the Pathfinder comics. And Skull Kickers.
Yeah, D&D. Did he do the D&D?
He did doing the new D&D comic.
New Red Sonja.
Yeah.
Conan.
Yeah.
So this guy who knows fantasy, fun comic writer.
So he posted a hashtag to Twitter, four comics. And the notion was sort of four comics that had an influence on you as a kid, or four comics that you were, that you know, sort of made you fall in love with comics, whatever it was. And tons of creators posted. Like, if you're on Twitter... Or even on Facebook, I think you can do some hashtags. Look up the four comics hashtag, because usually they would post these four covers and they maybe talk a little bit about it. And all these creators, you know, comics, artists and writers talking about the comics that made them love comics. I was surprised how much X-Men number one came up. That was clearly very formative for...
Like 1990?
Yeah, 1992, yeah.
Yep.
But I posted mine. And I posted on Twitter, and we'll probably post these on our site at some point.
So are we going to go down the list?
Yeah, yeah.
One of us kind of do ours. These are somewhat, I will say, at least for mine, somewhat hastily chosen and could be different almost the next day.
Yeah, sure.
There's a lot of influential comics.
No, we're going to hold you to it.
So don't hold me to this in court.
Well, my picture is actually slightly different than the one I'm announcing because I realized after I put the picture up, there was one that did not make my list.
Yeah.
Which was the G.I. Joe number 21, the Silent Issue. Which I would sub in for the Amazing Spider-Man issue that I put in there.
Right.
Because
right.
that was definitely one of my formative comics.
Right.
But then there's the X-Men number 200, which was where the Magneto trial sort of took place and was a big part of the Claremont X-Men, which, funnily enough, I believe, Dave, is where you fell off of X-Men.
That is actually true. Or it was close to the end days for
me.
My X-Men reading was about probably, I guess, 50 issues or so. I came in probably around issue 150. I did backtrack a little bit through trading with friends, and then I read it up to about 200.
Yeah, 200 is about where I started.
Actually, I take that back. I probably read it through 220, but it was starting to backtrack down there.
Whereas to me, I came in at like 195 during Secret Wars 2, and then 200 was where it sort of hooked me. And then Suicide Squad, notably the Phoenix Gambit, which is sort of toward the end of the book's lifespan, maybe the last year and a half, where they sort of abandoned the costumes and went more of an espionage direction. And that was a book that I always loved, but that was sort of, and I went back later and caught that whole book and loved all of it, but I came in a little late. And then finally the, Avengers, number 273, which is one of the, remember they did those 25th anniversary covers
with all the faces
that had had a frame
of like a portrait of a close up of a character's face.
In this case, the Black Knight by John Buscema and Tom Palmer. But the frame had like all the characters. It had like black costume Spider-Man and Iron Man and the Fantastic Four.
Was it the Silver Centurion Iron Man?
It was Silver Centurion Iron Man. It was all the 80s versions of characters sort of on a frame.
Right.
And it was done by Michael Golden, I think.
Oh, that makes sense.
And it was really cool. And But that issue was also like either the beginning or the prologue to the Masters of Evil Takeover the Mansion story.
Oh, yeah.
That's which was sort of my formative amazing formative Avengers stuff, and that was my Avengers. Like I stayed on that book for a good long time. So that's my four comics. Dave?
Let's see. So I made two lists when you told me this. Like,
so basically, you're a cheater.
I am absolutely a cheater, and one of my lists even has like bonus ones. I'm like, maybe this should be on there.
Oh, you're a cheater.
But one was basically from my preteens when I first got into comics, and then one is from my teens when I sort of shifted companies. Yep. But preteen list: New Mutants Special Edition number one.
Yep.
That was a. I was thinking it was an annual, and it was just like it was oversized like an annual. But it was a New Mutants Go to Asgard story with art by the then bursting onto the scene Art Adams, who made everything look cool. And I was like, how can Asgard look so cool? It's amazing. And the New Mutants basically have lots of life-changing events in Asgard. Some of them love it and have a great time, and they all get split up. And then some of them, bad things happen too. But it was an awesome issue, and I endlessly reread that. G.I. Joe 21, which has been mentioned as just sort of a emblematic of the whole series.
Just curious, is that all three of ours?
No. Really? I actually have another G.I. Joe.
Oh, okay.
What? All right.
No, I can see that. I can think of at least two others that could have made my list.
I have Thor 337, which is
that the Thor Frog issue?
No, that is the start of the
Beta Ray Bill storyline. Yeah.
It really marks the first time I think I had connected with John Byrne as an artist first because of his kind of like slick realism.
Yeah.
But I think Walt Simonson might have connected more, had more of an impact once I realized I was like, I really like this, and he's really stylized. I can always spot his artwork.
Yeah.
And so aside from the fact that that was what introduced Beta Ray Bill and all this stuff, it was just it was like an explosion of new visual iconography into my brain. I was like, oh, I can like a lot of other stuff now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And lastly, this was just sort of a entry point into all things Marvel for me. I could have, by the way, put an issue of Dazzler on here, which was one of the first comics I got, and a bunch of X-Men, like all the Marvel heroes showed up at one of her concerts.
Yeah.
But slightly more, less embarrassing, I should say, is Avengers, I believe it was 211, I just quick looked it up. This was a issue that was written by Jim Shooter, art by Gene Colan, and it was and the old order changeth. It was one of those ones where they called on new membership, and I got to see all of these characters showing up at the mansion, bickering with each other, arguing. Moondragon had some gambit she was pulling where she was trying to manipulate something going on there.
Yeah.
But for me, it was like, sort of introduced me to Beast and Wonder Man as buddies. You know, had a lot of Jim Shooter had some kind of fun, wry humor in there. And I just got to see so many characters that I was like, I want to know more what these guys do. Anyway, that's my core list.
Okay. Nick, you're four?
Okay. So the G.I. Joe comic would be G.I. Joe number two.
Yeah.
That was the...
I almost put that on mine, except it was a few years after that I learned to really appreciate that one.
Yeah, it was the Arctic. It had Quinn. It had Snake Eyes in his badass outfit with the... He ends up getting Quinn's necklace.
Yep.
It was just an all-around great issue.
It's an ultimate manly bonding issue.
Yep.
It is.
It's like watching the Great Escape.
The other G.I. Joe that I think is the obvious one that would go on the list would be number 11, which is the one that was on the ads.
Snowjob one.
Snowjob, and introduced Destro as a shadowy figure.
Yeah, that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
Next one is Captain America number 337.
Which one is that?
It's actually the first comic I ever bought myself.
Oh, yeah?
It was basically Cap no longer was Captain America.
Was that the one where the commission called him out, or was it right after
that? No, it was after that. They were, it's basically where they go to Las Vegas.
Oh, I love that issue.
D-Man gives him the U.S. agent outfit.
Yeah.
D-Man is actually kind of a badass, and he lifts a car out of a, like, crevice cave.
Uh-huh. And there are serpent themed bad guys holding up the casino.
The Serpent Society.
Yeah, that's a great run.
It was a great issue, and I've read that comic multiple times. There's a graphic novel that sort of gets slipped in here because I remember my mom buying a Batman. She didn't know. She just thought it was a Batman comic.
Yeah, sure.
Couldn't be bad for a kid.
Sure.
But this is Batman, Son of the Demon.
Yeah.
Which is a little more adult.
Yeah.
Because it was coming around in the late 80s, right when they did the Killing Joke and Arkham Asylum and stuff, right?
But this was a done in one, or at least I read it as, you know, full, complete story.
Yeah.
And it had Ra's al Ghul, it had all sort of the trappings. This is where he sleeps with
Was it Denny O'Neill or was it?
No, it's not Jim Starlin. It's Mike Barron, maybe?
It's Mike Barron, yeah. I think. Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. And
Jerry Bingham on art.
Yeah, it was really good. It was just the colors were very kind of acidic at times, and I think I just remember being really, really engrossed in it.
I like that. I actually flipped through that the other day when I was on going through my back issues on my or going through my shelves and pulled it out and looked at it.
It's violent as
it is.
Be.
It is,
and it's mainly their sort of bad guy. What's his name? Quain or
yeah, something
like
that.
And they use the black blood. I remember that being very vividly, sort of like Barry Windsor Smith's Weapon X.
Yeah,
and it was kind of gruesome.
Perhaps
stuff.
At the time, either to become an affectation or the comics code forbade the red blood.
Red blood, so it's black kind of, blood. Yeah, which made it creepier. Actually,
I there were issues of Micronauts that my brother had as a kid. They were surprisingly violent, the ones that had the when they were definitely doing their Star Wars riff. And so Baron Karza, much like it's clearly inspired by Darth Vader's throat crushing, he would like launch off his fist in the style of the toy and it would strangle his enemies. I remember one where this guy is going down and there is like black blood gurgling out of his mouth and it's horrific.
Well, it's funny, Nick. No wonder your Morrison's Batman sort of clicked with you as much because it's so based on Son of the Demon is really the origin of Damien.
It is.
And a lot of people don't necessarily know. I don't know if that's even still in print.
They did it as a sort of a single issue reprint.
Right.
A couple years back.
That's right.
And my fourth one, and this actually I could split into two because there's two different sections. As a kid, X-Men number one, I was a fan of.
Yeah.
I mean, it was Jim Lee art, had all the fun designs, had the blue and gold team, had them playing basketball in the first issue, if I'm not mistaken.
I actually really loved X-Men number one when I bought it, but I can't consider it childhood because I was 21 at that point.
Right.
I believe, if I'm not mistaken, Wolverine was supposed to be like, they were almost running with the notion that he was getting a little bit old.
Yeah.
And Gambit was the hot shot.
Yep.
He was
Gambit
whipping him on the court. Except I remember at the end, Wolverine clawed down the goal. Post.
You know what though? I thought I remember the basketball game being an issue like number two.
Oh, was it two?
It was number two.
Oh, that's
possible. The first one was the
Asteroid M stuff.
Asteroid M.
It had Asteroid M, but
it opens with Asteroid M.
Right, but it also has the whatever team, blue and gold team, sort of infiltrating the X Mansion, sort of as a training exercise.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And I liked seeing Wolverine and his group going in through the sewers and sort of having their sort of exposition there. But it was
I remember
fun
Rogue carrying Colossus. I think maybe. She was like flying with him, and then she drops him, and
he armors up and smashes through.
Yeah,
they use him
like a cannonball.
It was sort of a unique use of powers, which I am always a fan of.
Claremont was always pretty good at that. He was good with action, and he could. Especially if you didn't know the characters. Like, I had seen a lot of intros from him like that at that point. But if that was your entry point, it was like, you know, he had these very energetic, character-driven intros were still very superhero-y.
Yeah.
You know? And the reason I say that I could split this one in half is those were the ones I read as a kid that sort of got me into comics and made me love the medium. And then I sort of got out of comics for a long while. And then X-Men... I don't know what issue it was when Morrison came out. The first trade paperback.
The new X-Men,
new X-Men. That sucked me right back into comics, and I've been into it ever since.
Dave, do you want to read your cheater picks?
Yeah, I'll just get out my cheater picks. This is my teenage Dave, who had just switched over to DC because they had done Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Yep.
And some of my favorite creators, like John Byrne, had moved over to DC. So, Man of Steel number one.
Yep.
I could have said that of almost any of the launches. There are Action Comics and Superman came out of that, but also from him.
Yeah.
But Man of Steel, emblematic. Suicide Squad, number one.
Yeah.
I was on board from the beginning, loved it from the beginning.
Yep.
Dark Knight Returns was very formative. I almost could have picked...
Year One,
but I believe at the time I was much more... I was in the same way. I was fascinated with Walt Simonson's stylish art.
Yeah,
Frank Miller's art. I had to wrap my head around because at first I didn't like it, and then I loved it. And,
yeah,
you know, and it was also that brutally violent. You know,
yeah.
And lastly, Wonder Woman number one from George Perez.
Yeah,
and there were several other contributors, but he would go on to be the long running creator on that. And I felt like that was a kind of a stretch because as a kid, I was like, I don't know if I should read this girl's comic. You know, I was like worried about that.
I think it was very. I mean, it was pretty good. I mean, just overall, there was no. Right.
There was nothing that was particularly girly about it. But that was like my mind was worried about
because
I was like a dumb little teenager, and you know, but it had like cool Jason the Argonauts action and mythology. There was a, you know, the editor was Karen Berger, so it did have a little bit of that proto-Vertigo serious tone to it, which meant that it lined up sort of like with the serious comics that I had read as a kid, like X-Men or, Teen Titans from Wolfman.
Yeah.
It had some more of that edge.
I remember it being a very dense read.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know that I noticed that at the time, because I was used to Perez's art sort of being dense, but yeah, I'm sure looking back it would feel that way. Anyway, those are my cheater picks. I was pretty much an all DC person at the time for a good long while.
So finally, one bit of comics casting news. We saw that David Tennant has been cast in the Daredevil show.
Right, as the...
Not Daredevil. It's an Alias.
Alias, you're right. Oh, yeah, right. You're right. Alias.
As the villainous...
As the Purple Man.
Purple Man, okay, is it Zebediah?
Zebediah Kilgrave? Kilgrave.
Yeah, Kilgrave. Yeah. Zebediah Kilgrave.
Which... he has a particularly nasty vibe from Alias. So.
If you name your son Zebediah Kilgrave, you know he's going to be a villain.
It's probably true, actually.
You know, one of the very first comics I had as a kid, purchased, by the way, at a small comic fair at Northcross Mall that I was taken to like, and they're like, here, let's go take Dave and he can go maybe find a collector's item or something like that. You know, my parents didn't know anything about comics. They're like, maybe you can find a collector's item. And I bought like one or two comics. And one of them was this team-up. I don't have it anymore, and I need to track it down at some point. But I had a bunch of different heroes fighting the Purple Man.
Yeah.
And at the time, he was I think he was sort of a spy and sometimes robber and thief who generally just used his – he had the power that he could like sort of – you had to obey him.
Yeah.
If he said something and you heard it, you had to obey him.
Yep.
Heroes would have to find ways around that, you know, attack him without, you know, with their ears plugged up and stuff like that. Be all Odysseus style.
Yeah.
And, you know, he'd be like, Daredevil and Spider-Man fight each other. And that was who he was back then.
Yep.
It was still kind of very classic superhero tropes. Now, if we filter that through the more modern sensibilities of psycho, you know, the serious adult themes, then you say, what would what kind of creepy things could a guy do if he could command people to do anything for him? What if he was a creepy sex pervert guy? Well, that's sort of what happened in the comic Alias.
Yeah. And
this is David Tennant. So.
I think he's going to be great at it. I think it's perfect casting.
And honestly, although I sort of hated him in the comics, and I will say this, by the way, Bendis. It's in some ways it's not as bad as you think.
It's more restrained than you would think. Yeah, definitely.
Right. But they did give him something of that creepy predatory vibe, a little bit of sexual predator.
He's not
vibe.
A nice guy.
No.
And I suspect that the show is going to find a sort of some workaround so it's not quite as creepy as it was in the comic.
Yeah,
and I hope they do.
Or they could go full on Hannibal Lecter. Who knows?
Yeah, we'll see.
I do think that Tennant will really elevate the game.
He's got the chops. He'll do a great job with the character.
Yeah. Finally, one last bit of casting news that is comics adjacent.
Comics adjacent, yeah. It's just it's in the pop world as animation.
Yeah, it's not animation.
Well, I mean, that is to say, it came from animation.
Yeah.
If we're talking about
so Emma Watson is going to be playing Belle in a live action Beauty and the Beast movie.
Presumably, in the tradition of the Cinderella thing they've got coming up, and like Maleficent and stuff like that.
Yeah. And that's kind of cool. I like her.
Yep. I think she's going to be good for it. I like this. I saw a friend repost her tweet or whatever about it. And she's just like she's wildly giddy about it, you know. I think she was very enamored of Belle when she was young.
Sure,
it was like her heroine, and you know, given that she's now doing like really like trying to like become an important figurehead for like women's rights.
Yeah.
It's interesting to think about the impact that a character like Belle might have had on her. That was for Disney at the time when they were still kind of. Had a foot in the old style fairy tales.
Still doing princesses, yeah.
Still doing kind of old timey princesses, and suddenly here comes Belle, who rejects Gaston, who's a reader first, and all of this stuff. I can understand why she's made such an impact, and I think she'll be really good at it.
Yep. All right, we'll be back in just a few minutes or a few seconds to talk about comics for the week. I'm waking up to ash and dust. I wipe my brow and I sweat my rust. I'm breathing. So we're talking about comics coming in on Wednesday, January 28th. And Nick, I believe you were enthusiastic for so much stuff. We're going to let you lead off the band here with three.
I thought you were going to let me close.
Three cheater picks. Go ahead.
I liked three comics so much.
Okay,
that
one is a regular pick. Two are cheater picks.
In the time we had, we haven't hit as many like impactful ones as we sometimes do.
Yep.
But Nick has, and so that's why you get to run the show for me.
Yeah.
Oh,
you run the show. We're going to go back. We're going to go back and smoke.
Okay.
Don't smoke, kids.
I don't smoke, but we're going to take up smoking. Don't smoke, kids.
Well, if anybody knows me, they know I like Grant Morrison. So, Multiversity Guidebook. It is the guidebook of the DC Multiverse.
It is just the latest issue of Multiversity.
It is. Yeah. It is. Yeah. It is. It is that. So this comes out, and it pretty much has Grant Morrison and then every artist known to man, kind, because they do pinups for every single one of the Earths.
It's a little like their old DC's Who's Who.
Yeah.
But the little group shots.
Group shots and then sort of a rundown of what Earth is. But not only that, you do get a full issue of Multiversity as well. Sort of a chibi Batman and a Batman from a...
Well, it's from Dustin Nguyen's Batman Little Gotham, isn't it?
Or is it just sort of like that?
I guess it's not.
Of like that.
Okay, I thought it was from there.
That there is a reference to Little Gotham in there.
Okay.
As sort of a... all these characters live and tell their stories through other comic books. So one of those comic books that the chibi Batman picks up is Little Gotham. But it's that, and then a future Batman from sort of an Adam Strange apocalypse world is their team up sort of dealing with problems. There's also Commandy involved, and sort of a rundown of actually all of DC's history through the different crises that has occurred, which I thought was kind of interesting.
It was interesting to me that they would do a Multiversity Guidebook as a regular issue. Guidebooks are kind of a big thing in comics. Like,
it is.
When we were doing our top four influential comics, one cheater pick that I did mention,
Marvel Universe,
a cheater pick.
Oh my god!
Was the official handbook of the Marvel Universe?
Yeah, that could go on my list too.
It could mine.
I have like a very specific memory of like buying the second issue of the deluxe edition, which I had sort of skipped the first edition somehow. I think I was a kid and I didn't have any money, and like I bought it like at a B. Dalton bookstore and all this I endlessly reread it.
So yeah,
it's just one of those things. So I understand why Morrison would kind of make that part of the comic itself.
The guidebook is cool, but honestly, it is like the guidebook is a full-on issue, and then the issue, it's like a big issue. It's double or triple size.
It is. It really, really is, and it's worth every penny.
There's some amazing artists in there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, just the artists. And just to give you sort of a glimmer of what some of the Earths are, so I think there's like, if you remember Batman Thrill Killer.
Yep.
So they've been Burton's sort of incorporated into Earth 37. There's an Earth where Darwin Cook's sort of continues on.
We saw the Justice Riders one, which was
Justice Riders.
It was an Elseworlds that had basically Justice League in the Old West.
Yep.
There's also Batman Vampire.
That's Earth 43. Yeah. Don't go there. Vampires.
Don't go there. Bad stuff occurs. And then if you liked Justice League, and Batman Beyond, Justice League Unlimited is what I was going to say. They actually have the, what were they called?
Justice Lords.
Justice Lords. The evil that has actually been incorporated into it.
Autocratic Justice League.
And it's really just one of those books that I could see myself sort of just poring over and really, really enjoying. It's just crammed with all kinds of goodness for me.
Speaking of giant-sized comics.
Speaking of giant-sized comics, we have a Jonathan Hickman new series by him and artist...
Ryan Bodenheim?
Yeah, Bodenheim.
Another big Image book.
It is. It is double-sized, isn't it?
It's 64 pages.
64 pages.
It's technically triple-sized.
Right. And the title of it is The Dying and the Dead. And it focuses on sort of... It's kind of one of Hickman's sort of hard-to-explain concepts.
It's a weird one. It's not on, like, say, East of West.
Right.
But just flipping through it, it looks like there's two stories interweaving.
There's our world and the world underneath it, sort of that kind of through machinations controls us.
Uh-huh.
And an artifact of theirs gets stolen. And they can't act upon it, so they have to find sort of a person that can be their emissary.
Uh-huh.
And a person who's worked with them and his wife is dying.
Who are they?
They're like gods and other things beneath that are too otherworldly for us to grasp.
It's not unlike, say, the Endless in Sandman,
right,
or the Horsemen in East of West.
But
there's sort of otherworldly beings, but in humanoid form.
And there's a lot of sort of things we've seen in other comics, like secret societies and sort of like Mignola-esque villainous plots going on. And I actually just thought it was really well The art is fantastic.
Is the tone action, suspense, strange mystery?
Strange mystery is closer.
Strange mysteries and a little bit of action. There's some stuff. There's some really good action bits in here too.
Yeah.
And really just kind of this eeriness of a long conversation between a man and these otherworldly beings. So
it feels like the kind of book that like Peter Milligan would have done at Vertigo.
Yeah, that's a good call. Anyways, I really think it's worth your time. I really enjoyed it. And my final cheater pick, because, yep, you know, there had to be one more. My favorite thing that Matt Fraction has ever written has been his Casanova series. There were 3 volumes of it previous.
Now collected into 2 hardcovers,
now
right?
Collected into 2 hardcovers. This the new one is called Casanova Acedia, or Acadia, however you pronounce it.
Yep.
And Casanova is back. And the one thing I wish this book had was sort of a what happened previous to this, because it's been a little while since I've read it. But it's essentially Casanova has no memory.
Yeah, he doesn't know who he is.
He doesn't know who he is, so he's sort of working for another person who found him, sort of like born identity.
He's the one that was like the
thing.
Crazy spy stuff.
He's like a cross-dimensional spy.
Pretty much. And it sort of goes from there. He doesn't know who he is.
There's a little born identity to it. Like, he's a spy. He has all these skills. He doesn't know where he got it.
And some people, there are obviously people in the world who know who he is.
There are boobs.
I'm just going to ask.
There are boobs.
You were flipping through it, and I'm pretty sure I saw boobs.
There are boobs and violence.
There's boobs and violence. That's sort of been this kind of through line through all the issues.
Is it spoofing spy stuff, or is it sort of like an affectionate...
No, it's not even spies. It's a little more... It's a little weirder than that.
It's weirder. It's kind of time-hoppy, cross-dimensional, different parallel universe type things. So... It's kind of bizarre, but it's also just hits my funny bone of just great storytelling.
Okay.
I like it more than Sex Criminals, which I know you guys are both like why that?
It does does have very cool art.
Oh, well, the art, they flip-flop. And
I actually don't have a strong opinion on this because I've never read it.
But it's Gabriel Ba and Fabio Moon. This one is Fabio Moon doing the art.
Yeah.
He's just amazing. If you, what was this, one of his other books?
I could almost recommend it to people on the basis of the art alone. Because if nothing else, that art is stunning.
And the one thing that this book actually has that the others have not, Matt Fraction is actually working with a co-writer, and that is Michael Chabon.
Is he a co-writer? Is he writing the back? He writes a backup story.
Does he write the backup story?
Yeah, it's a backup story.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, maybe Michael Chabon just liked it enough that he's writing a backup story.
He of the prose novelist who wrote Cavalier and Clay and other Wonder Boys.
It is a really, really fun book. Great art. I suggest go reading all of Casanova and then picking up this issue because it's worth it.
It's crazy, super spy, sexy time.
Yep.
There we go. There's the line I'm looking for.
Dave, I know you and I were sort of on board one of the books that we've talked about a little bit before, but we may not have addressed in a while.
I hadn't hit anything that was quite grabbing me this week, and then I read this one, and I was like, oh my God, that was good.
Yeah.
And it was just a straight-up old-school superhero comic, but with some super fun ideas. This is Spider-Man 2099.
Yeah. What issue number are we on?
We're on number 8.
Yep, and we are in the middle of the Spider-Verse story.
Right, so there's lots of... in the previous issue, he was teaming up with a steampunk sort of Spider-Girl.
Lady Spider.
And she's got, like, these little, you know, mechanical spider legs, a little bit like Dr. Octopus's sort of harness that she wears.
And she's May Parker.
She's May Parker, which is to say, what, the daughter of a Peter Parker?
I think she's May Parker. I think
like
she's
Aunt May?
Yeah, Aunt May, basically.
A younger
Aunt May.
From a steampunk timeline.
Yeah, yeah.
And so even though they've been in his future, she knows tech better than he is because he's, what, like a biologist?
Yeah.
That is a Spider-Man 2099.
Yeah, he's a genetic engineering biologist dude. Yeah.
And she's like
she's an inventor. She invented her steampunk legs.
She has, like, super inventor powers.
Yeah.
And they're on the run from the what do they call them?
Inheritors.
The
evil bad guys.
And in this one, they take to her world to try and find to try and repair an asset.
Yeah.
Is it okay to say what the asset
is? Oh no, we got
to
leave the asset alone. I mean, it's so cool.
It's so good. and they have to go to her world to like try and get some gear. And they run into steampunk versions of... I think we can say it, right?
Yeah, we can say...
Steampunk versions of the Sinister Six.
Yes, but that's not their name in this world.
Yes, I forget exactly what it was. Do you remember it, Randy?
Not off the top of my head. I was hoping you would.
No, no.
It is the best name for the...
Here's
for the...
some awkward dead air time as we look it up.
I believe yes, she. Oh, the Six Men of Sinistry.
Yes, and I believe she makes fun of that. She's like, "Sinistry isn't even a word." Anyway, so you will see steampunk versions of Vulture, Dr. Octopus, Kraven. They're really fun. There's not too much more to say of the book other than that it is as much fun as that concept I think could be, and just the back and forth sort of partnership of Spidey 2099 and Lady Spider has been a lot of fun. But you suddenly throw in A, the asset that they are after, and B, the craziness of steampunk Sinister Six, and you've got a great issue.
Part of me is going to be sad to see Spider-Verse go. I mean, I'm looking forward to wrapping it up and all, but it's given us so many good stories.
They may find some ways to have it creep up every once in a while, you know, like a gateway that doesn't perpetually, you know, ever fully close so that Spider-Man will occasionally...
Well, this is one of the things... There's a 2099 zone in the battle world, and I'm looking forward to more of Spider-Man 2099 sort of experiencing that and maybe a little more of his universe. Maybe Lady Spider will be in there, but... I think seeing Peter David play around with this stuff will be fun. And yes, Ravage 2099, future Garbage Man, hopefully.
Yeah, I liked all the 2099 characters. I would love to even see some of the X-Men 2099.
So my picks of the week, as it were, are two books that I've actually been reading and recommended numerous times. But they're sort of – they feel like flip sides of the same coins, comics that I don't think would have existed 10 years ago or 5 years ago maybe. They would have been just eaten by a harsh market.
Right.
But that is Bitch Planet, number 2, is this week, by Kelly Sue DeConnick and Valentin Delandro. And that is a crazy sci-fi feminist book, really. This one, you know how the first issue of Bitch Planet was sort of prison
exploitation? Feminism is so crazy.
Yeah, it's – you know how the first one was sort of an – it was a riff on the exploitation prison – women in prison genre.
Right, right.
Well, this one is without getting too much into it. It reminds you a little bit of that second episode of Black Mirror where they're sort of dealing with people in the entertainment industry, sort of, you know, how they affect the world. And also, weirdly, it's sort of a sci-fi take on The Longest Yard, where the –
I've never seen The Longest Yard.
Where
so
the crooks are – the crooks make a football team to take on the guards as sort of a statement of purpose.
Oh, okay, right.
Like, you know, even if they win the game, they're still going to be in prison, but that they will have beaten the guards.
Right, okay.
So there's something like that in there. And it's really fun. It's really beautiful to look at, and I'm really digging this book. And it's also really funny. On the flip side, we have Sex Criminals number 10, which is the sex criminals are gathering their forces to deal with the sex police. Which, if you've read the book, that makes sense. If you haven't, you're like, what are you talking about? And really funny, really human, doing some great stuff with characters. And it's by Kelly Sue's husband, Matt Fraction, with art by Chip Zdarsky.
Did you intentionally pair them together? Ranger,
they match really well together. I think the two of them have sensibilities that fit, which is probably part of why they got married, is they probably had a lot in common.
Maybe, possibly.
But the sensibilities of both Matt Fraction and Kelly Sue DeConnick are similar enough that you can definitely see them playing. I'd love to see them co-write something, unless that maybe they would kill each other. I don't know. But I really like both these books, and I thought they both had exceptionally strong issues this week.
Do we want to run through a handful of other?
Yeah, Nick. What else is on your reading list this week?
I've got the newest issue of New Avengers, which has some pretty possible big things for Secret Wars.
Well, I think we can say the cover seems to show the Beyonder on it.
Yep, the Beyonder's playing around with Captain America.
No, not Captain America. That's
Yellow Jacket.
Oh, it's Yellow Jacket. Whatever, they all look the same.
Tim Seeley's new Vertigo book, Effigy, which I did get a chance to read. A little odd, but I did enjoy
sort
it.
Sort of a crime slice of life book.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to new Thor.
Yep, Thor number 4.
Thor number 4. Batman 38.
Yep.
Continues the Endgame, which has been fantastic so far. I'm still enjoying Jay Faber's, the first issue of Graveyard Shift, and this is the second one, so I'm looking forward to it.
Yep.
And finally, Wolverines, which I'm still really, really digging.
Cool.
Remind me, what is the hook of Graveyard Shift?
It's a sort of vampires. It's just a vampire comic.
Oh,
yep.
Okay.
Yep.
All
Dave, anything else on your reading list for this week?
Let's see. Mostly stuff that's been gone through. Oh, Uncanny Avengers has a new issue number one that I'll want to try. It's got... It continues the... I mean, it's Rick Remender, who was writing it before.
Yep.
This is, I guess, post the events of Axis,
yeah.
where some of the heroes and villains got sort of flipped by who is it? Onslaught's powers and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And if nothing else, flipping through this, Daniel Acuna's art, he's a cover art, a guy who, on his cover art, I used to make fun of his stuff and think it looked like this really cheap plastic characters. But his interior art, I think, is really quite beautiful. It looks like sort of like a color versions of Kirby's 60s art. And yet there's a sensibility that also fits sort of European sci-fi comics. I will be curious to peek in on that and see how it is. I've liked some of Remender's Uncanny Avengers. And this has the Vision now on the team. And it looks like a few other new members in the mix, among them Sabretooth, who has been flipped.
Yeah.
Let's see. Oh, right. So the other big thing is the King Features, who has all the kind of classic pulp comic strip characters,
yeah, sure.
like Flash Gordon and the Phantom and stuff. They are sort of relaunching or like a... Is this a mini-series, Randy?
It seems like a series of small series.
Right. It seems like they must have had an event that occurred where like the entire Earth was under
siege. Well, it looks like Ming may have invaded.
Right. And he was like... Presumably, he was repelled... And this represents a new status quo for all the books that occurred afterwards. And so there's a first issue of Flash Gordon that sort of follows in this setting, and there's a first issue of The Phantom, The Ghost Who Walks, in that setting as well. And they've got nice looking, you know, the creative teams look good, the art looks good, so I'll be interested to try that. I do like checking in on the pulp heroes.
Cool, cool.
I think that's it for me.
All right. Also, should mention Munchkin Number One, based on the card game, is out this week.
On our best-selling card game, or you know, our tabletop game.
And we just talked about X-Men Number One, so it's worth mentioning that the pop vinyls came out this week with their '90s. There's '90s X-Men pop vinyl. 90s, so
the '90s cartoons.
'90s cart. Well, they're not.
You're right. The cartoon was basically the look of the comics.
And these look. Yeah, these are more of the comic looking ones to me. But
for some reason, I was thinking it was the cartoon, but I guess it's the comic. Guys.
Yeah, it's. Xavier in his wheelchair, his gold floaty wheelchair.
Cyclops
with the packs. Magneto, Mystique, Colossus, Storm. It's a good little pack of stuff.
And so. I will say there are a couple of trades worth mentioning. The first volume of the Image book Outcast.
Yeah, Robert Kirkman's new book, $10.
$10. Right. So if you're in the mood for some horror and... it's actually pretty good. I really enjoyed it.
That's his Demonic Possession series. And this is sort of an opportunity to get it on the ground floor of, you know, the guy who created Walking Dead. Nobody was aware of it, really, or not many were when it first was coming out. Here's your shot to get it on his other horror book right when it's hitting.
And it is going to TV, too. So. Yeah.
And also the...
You could say that you were there when.
And also the second volume of Black Science, Rick Remender.
Right.
And is it Greg Ticini?
I think so.
Or is that low?
I don't know.
I always get a mix.
He's working with a bunch of artists, so I'm not
sure.
He is.
The second volume of that hits. So if you've been looking forward to catching up on that, now's the time.
All right. We will be back in just a few seconds to talk about some books, some games, some TV, some movies, all kinds of stuff. So stick around. So we have some ground to cover this week, gentlemen. I believe we've all been reading and watching and enjoying various things.
Yep.
And we're just going to run it down for people.
All right.
Awesome.
So
I liked it.
I'm going to start with, we mentioned the book challenge early on, and the book challenge is definitely driving me to read more books this year.
Yes. Yeah.
And two of the ones I've read recently, one of them was Feed, which is a post-zombie novel. It's actually it's a trilogy. It's part of the News Flesh trilogy. And it takes place in this sort of, this world where a cancer cure and a cure for the common cold intersect and make zombies.
Uh-huh.
So there's no cancer, there's no common cold, but there is zombies. And this is like...
Well, that seems like a bad trade-off.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is like...
Some people want zombies so much that I believe they would be fully... I mean, they're like, we get to cure cancer and I get to shoot zombies?
Yeah.
But I always figured that would last right up until they spent their first night sleeping in the zombie stench-ridden streets.
Well, here's the thing. It's not post-apocalyptic, really. I mean, there was a... There big, right. there was, zombies are still rising. And the deal is that everyone carries this virus in them, like it's live in them, and it can activate, like whenever the zombie bites you, that it can do it. But like it also gets animals. Uh-huh. Like there's – so what this book is about is a sort of a what happens in the world when the zombie uprising has happened. So
it's like there's sort of some equilibrium that's discovered.
The cities are fortified. They have all these disposable tests that are blood tests that you have to use to get anywhere. That you then throw in a biohazard bag in there, wirelessly connected to CDC so that they know if you're converting. And you can spontaneously convert. They're like, that is rare, but it does happen, where someone just, the amount of virus just gathers up and they become a zombie and an outbreak happens.
Right. So the world close, somewhat like our own, but less safe.
Well, and like, for example, animals is a big deal. Like they don't do, you can't have really pets anymore because animals over about 40 pounds can convert. So they don't really do horses and all that kind of stuff are sort of they're not looked upon fondly and that kind of thing. So there's all kinds of stuff like that. And also because the real journalists sort of blew off the zombie epidemic as being not a real thing, and the bloggers sort of picked up on it and ran with it, they have become sort of the default news. Like the mainstream news is sort of gone. And
like fun speculative fiction type stuff.
So the story focuses on these group of bloggers who are there's three of them. Their tech person is named Buffy after the Whedon character. She sort of took the name. Some of this pulp culture reference are a little on the nose, but her brother, there's a brother and sister, and the sister is what's called a newsie, and she's more of a news, they do the hard news people. And then her brother is what's called an Irwin after Steve Irwin that goes out and pokes at the zombies with sticks. And it's all like, they sell traffic on their YouTube channel and all this kind of stuff. Well, they get the call to cover the Republican nominee for president. Uh-huh. Or one of the nominees as he makes the run at the Republican nomination. And it's a sort of political thriller and a look into sort of the bloggers of this world and also sort of the zombie world building.
The backdrop of zombies.
And it's really interesting. I it took a few chapters to hook me, but I wound up really, really liking it.
Off the top of your head, do you remember the author's name?
It's Mira Grant. But she also it's a pen name. She writes sort of urban fantasy, sort of Dresden style, under the name Seanan McGuire.
Okay.
Which I believe is a real name. And this is – Newsless is a trilogy that came out, I think, in 2010. It's done. And she's working on another one that's called the Parasitology Trilogy that's about sort of ringworms causing zombieism or something. She likes to do these sort of medical combined with zombies.
Right.
But it's an interesting read. I really like that first book. And then that led me to finally read – and this is a bit of a diversion, but getting into sort of stuff that had been recommended – people have been recommending this forever. I'm finally reading Ready Player One, which is by an Austinite author.
One of the biggest sort of geek buzz books of the last few years, and for those who happen to not like it, one of the most hated books.
Yeah. You love or hate it. I wound up definitely loving it. I'm almost done with it. It's by Ernest Cline, I believe is his name. And it's basically a world where there's a future world. There's a interactive massive online game called Oasis that is also like so widespread that like people work there and kids go to school there. And in this thing, the guy who created it has died, and there's a challenge that if you can follow these three, unlock this three clue mystery that he has, that you will gain his $1 billion company and gain control of this Oasis technology. And it follows the story of this kid who's sort of going through this guy's obsession with his 80s and 90s pop culture that he grew up with. In this world. Uh-huh. So there's a world that's a recreation of Zork. It's like 155 different Zork houses.
Right.
And there's...
I wonder how many people listening know what Zork is.
He flies around in a Serenity-class spaceship. Right. Or a Firefly-class spaceship. And there's all kinds of stuff like... It's like
virtual world. It allows them to, it sounds like, drop almost any pop culture thing they want as sort of something that the characters can interact with.
Yes. I mean, there's a big sequence that involves the movie War Games.
Right.
There's a bunch of Japanese anime references. It's so filled with geek pop culture references. And I thought it might be a little much, and occasionally it is.
It may explode into 1,000 Pac-Mans.
But it's really fun if you have any kind of love for this kind of thing. And,
I had not been interested in it, Randy, too much, based on the sort of like, it sounded like I was just like, oh, this is just a bunch of masturbation for 80s property.
Sure, yeah.
But when you kind of described the sort of the raw plot to me earlier today, I was like, you know what? Now that I sort of see the framework for it, I think I could potentially enjoy that.
I've really liked it. I'm looking forward to finishing it up tonight. So I definitely recommend both those books. And then, Nick, I know you just powered through a TV series that was my favorite TV show of the year.
I did. I actually was able to procure a copy on the cheap at my local Best Buy.
Yeah.
this TV show is Fargo, which, you know, I loved the Joel and Ethan Coen
the movie. Me too.
I randomly watched it thinking, as a much younger lad,
yeah.
And thinking, I think my mom rented it thinking it was a comedy. Boy, was she wrong.
It's got its humor.
Right, but that sounds like when my mom and my sister went to see In Bruges.
Yeah.
Trying to get over, sadly, the loss of a pet.
Yeah.
They were like, let's go watch this comedy In Bruges. The trailers look so funny. And it is like a dark...
Oh, that is dark comedy. Yeah.
Now, there are some hysterical moments
sure.
in it. Yeah. But for the most part, it is like a... heart-wrenching kind of movie, and that's what Fargo was.
Yeah, the movie Fargo was very sort of filled with odd characters and, you know, dark humor, but, you know, a lot of tragedy as well.
And it's one of the Coen's greats, so the notion of remaking it as a TV show in any way...
I heard about it. Yeah, I was like, that,
sounds
that
horrible.
Can't possibly
work. It sounds horrible.
This follows the money that was the sort of MacGuffin in the first movie.
Yeah, but you're not supposed to have heard that.
I'm not supposed to have heard that?
No, that was such a great reveal when you find it out.
Yeah.
That's too bad. No, it's all right.
No.
I thought you just told me.
No, I'm sad for you if I haven't heard that.
That's something about it.
Yeah, it's
I assume it's about the execution and the characters and stuff.
But that is the main link, is that...
That is the link.
It looks like one thing. It looks like it's sort of a prequel-esque take on Fargo, and then it reveals itself to be very different.
It intersects or something at some point.
But, I mean, the gist is just a Martin Freeman's character.
I forgot Martin Freeman was even like the
main
guy.
Martin Freeman is playing the
William H. Macy
part, essentially.
You know, he doesn't get along with his wife all that much. He's a kind of nag.
He's not
a used
car guy, though.
He's not. No. He's actually an insurance salesman.
Yeah.
Okay.
Life insurance.
But he's in that mold.
But he's definitely
a little desperate
in that
and weird guy.
And he befriends in the very first scene of the show.
Yeah.
He's in the emergency room, and Billy Bob Thornton is sitting next to him. And Billy Bob is, as you can imagine, he's the devil. He's very evil.
He's the devil crossed with Loki. He is there to cause mischief and murder people and drive people.
He is the devil.
He drives people to their worst possible impulses because he thinks it's fun.
Now, this actually sounds like beyond the realities, the realistic, quasi-realistic scope of Fargo.
It's not.
Okay.
I mean, he's not like the devil. He's not supernatural.
He's not the actual
devil.
But
I also don't know a lot of people in life who exist to walk around providing temptation.
You know, that's not what he does. He's actually there. He represents a crime syndicate. He's a freelancer.
Okay.
And he just, for fun, while he's doing his job, he just kind
of
messes with people's lives.
Essentially.
Yeah. He's kind of a sociopath, basically.
I really want to see this series. It sounds very good.
The casting is so good.
Those two people, the woman who plays sort of the female lead of the
Allison
show.
Tolman is playing what looks to be sort
like
of
Frances McDormand's character.
Frances McDormand, except she's not the chief.
Right.
She's like a younger cop.
Yeah.
And
she's amazing in it.
She's really good.
Honestly, in a lot of ways, even when you're in the room with powerhouses like Martin Freeman and Billy Bob, she really shines.
Yeah.
It's just fantastic.
Keith Carradine plays her ex-cop dad.
Yep.
Colin Hanks plays a cop who
Keith Carradine.
So runs afoul of Malvo early on.
Yep. And, you know, it's just all those people you're kind of like, oh, that's that guy. What is it? Paul Odenkirk?
Bob Odenkirk plays the chief. Oliver Platt is in there. Kate Walsh is in there.
Yep.
It's all... Key and Peele show up later on. And it's such a good story. I mean, there's so many great characters.
How many episodes?
Ten episodes.
Okay.
And I will say, I would put this in sort of the addictive television.
Yeah.
Because... once I put the discs in, I wanted to churn through them. I did not want to stop
watching.
Did you
rent it or
buy it? I bought
it.
I bought it.
Yeah. This was my favorite TV show of last year. Last year was a great year for TV. This topped True Detective for me. It topped Flash.
Well, I think it's a little more approachable than True Detective. True Detective is brutal.
It is. It's darker and weirder. This is definitely dark, but it's in a sort of a quirkier...
But it has the Coen brothers' quirkiness to it, and I think that's what sort of elevates
curiosity,
it.
Do they produce, or do they sign
their
off
names
on
are on it? actually kind of funny. I watched a little bit of behind the scenes because I was interested, and apparently they met with them... The Coen brothers read, like, the first script and saw the first episode, and they were like, go... Oh,
They basically said, yeah, this is good. That's the extent of the Coen brothers' involvement. And that's really all you need.
Although, in a weird way, that's pretty big because I kind of thought they were the kind of guys who might be like, Well, we didn't really own the property. We don't approve of this.
Yeah.
We wish it would.
No, this definitely had their blessing.
Apparently it was a failed pilot starring a few people years ago for NBC.
And it would not have worked on NBC. This was an FX show, and it needed to be an FX show.
It is brutal, and it's very much in the Fargo vein. Mm-hmm. So
it sounds really good.
I would highly, highly recommend finding it and me watching too. It.
Dave, you and I watched the first episode of 12 Monkeys on Sci-Fi.
Hey, I watched it too.
Oh, Nick watched it too, but you didn't watch it with us.
I didn't watch it with you guys.
Therefore, we don't consider you to have watched
it. This is a movie that I think we all have a certain degree of fondness for.
But it falls in sort of the same Fargo-esque thing. I didn't think it needed to be made into a television series.
Me neither.
Series.
Right. And I only sort of, I liked the movie okay, but was not a huge fan. I actually had been, when I saw the trailer for the show months and months ago, despite what seemed like a somewhat youthful cast, not quite WB youthful,
right.
But youthful, I was like, oh, those people are kind of weirdly attractive for what had been a Terry Gilliam film about strange people.
Right.
But I was like, oh, I kind of like what I see in this trailer. Wow, I might actually like this better than the movie. And so I had been curious, and then the early buzz was like, oh, this might actually be good. People were saying good things about it.
I had a huge fondness for Terry Gilliam's 12 Monkeys. I think
it's actually on my to rewatch list.
I went through a period of time. I managed a video store before this, and I was very much into a sort of Terry Gilliam mode, so I watched all, like, Time Bandits.
What, yeah.
Brazil, all the sort of weird quirkiness that Terry Gilliam. I watched the commentary of 12 Monkeys with that Gilliam did.
Oh, wow.
It is insane to listen to that man sort of go in depth into certain scenes.
I'd like to do that. When I rent it, I'll have to listen to the commentary. Anyway, so what do we think on this movie?
I thought the first episode was really good.
The pilot was very well executed.
Yeah. It's got a nice – the tension of the opening scene where he first travels back and visits this scientist and is sort of trying to convince her that – like he basically kidnaps her and she thinks she's being kidnapped by a crazy person.
And there are
and then some stuff happens that sort of convinces –
Can we say what happens in the very beginning?
Yeah, yeah.
It's huge.
He blinks out. I mean
– Right, but can we say kind of what happens?
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
He gets shot.
Yeah.
And people – you know, it does look like he's kidnapping her. A cop shoots him. He's winged. He's not dead, but he's hurt.
He's hit bad.
And he's, like, before he, what, disappears, he says that he'll see her again.
Meet me in 2 years at this hotel.
Right. And so that time passes. And by the way, one of the sort of conceits of it is that she generally kind of believes him right out of the gate.
Well, she didn't, though.
Well, right.
She thought he was crazy, and then he vanished in front of her.
Right, but she did spend those 2 years thinking about
and
that.
In this pilot, there is a lot of correlation with the actual movie.
Right.
Madeline Stowe's character is very much, very much the I don't know who the actress who plays the main female. And the young man, the guy who plays Bruce Willis's character, Cole, which we know from he played Pyro in X2 and X3.
Okay. I forgot it was that guy, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they go through very much the same stages as sort of the first movie.
Right. And before you go, let me just jump back for just a second and say, so the guy had been shot. The 2 years elapse. She goes to the designated place.
He shows up a week late.
He shows up, that's right, it's a week late. She's been waiting at like a bar, waiting and waiting.
And she's starting to lose faith. Yeah.
Right. She's starting to lose faith. And what does he like stumble up?
He stumbles up still shot, like newly shot.
Right. Right. And it was, you know, we've seen time travel stuff before, but the particular vagaries of how this one works and the kind of quirkiness of it was appealing and seeing it somewhat subvert what Terry Gilliam had done, which is to say, obviously, if you just made a show that covered the precise events, it would be boring. It has to subvert it in some way or throw some twists at it.
Yeah.
And they are clearly going to throw some twists at it. The thing that he did with The Watch also, to kind of convince, or was it her or somebody else?
It was to get time later on.
Right.
But I actually,
lots of neat ideas in it, I guess, is the larger point.
I really liked that she bought into it earlier. That was one of the biggest things. Usually with these things, they spend two episodes with her being the skeptic. And it's annoying because we all know, as the audience, what the deal is.
And I'm torn on it because I agree on that. And yet at the same time, I thought she bought it too fast.
I mean, well, the guy vanished in front of her.
In front of you, you're kind of like...
No, it's not so much that that she bought it, I guess, is not how I should say it. She decided I'm interested in going along with this a little too enthusiastically.
Well,
he just told her that. I mean, but she...
It destroys her life.
Yeah. She just... I mean, she...
She didn't feel like her life had been destroyed to me.
Really? Because, I mean, she had... Well, we knew from his original thing was that she was supposed to be at the CDC by that time, and instead, she was discredited, didn't have a job.
it seemed to me like there was a certain light tone to the thing where they could, like, they sort of fell into what I think of as, like, not buddy cop tropes, but that sort of back and forth thing and an easy friendship that seemed a little weird to me. There was something off-putting about it. A little unearned.
I can see that. I actually was okay with it. You're right that it's sort of a shortcut thing.
Right.
But I liked it because I didn't want to see – I didn't need to see all the build-up. I didn't need to see them buying into it because I know where they're going, and right. I'd rather just get to the
– I don't necessarily discount it. Like, I want to see the second episode.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. It's on. I just haven't watched it yet.
Yeah, and I agree. But I think more importantly, I think this is just based on sort of, you know, special effects and sort of money, budget – Sci-fi's yeah. putting a lot into this show.
I feel like if somebody thinks they might like it, or like they're either the time travel or they like the original 12 Monkeys, or maybe even didn't like it,
yeah,
that it's probably worth their time to try out.
Yeah, I'm just surprised because, you know, a lot of sci-fi is kind of looks a little cheap. I hate to say that of a network, but it kind of does.
Yeah.
This one doesn't feel cheap. It feels more on the level of, like, Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah, right? Although it does still feel shot in Vancouver or whatever.
Well, yeah, of course.
I don't think I particularly noticed any cheapness to it at all.
Well, I'm not talking about 12 Monkeys being cheap. I'm just talking about sci-fi's other productions in general. Yeah,
is that a thing that they should
Yeah, do? They tend to look a little cheap.
Yeah, I mean, Battlestar Galactica was definitely a notable difference.
Yeah,
it was one they put the money into, and this one feels like...
Well, it's very cinematic.
But yeah. I honestly think sci-fi's trying to cement themselves a little bit, because they did the trailer for The Expanse,
yeah,
which is coming up, and that actually looked pretty polished as well.
Yeah.
Right. Maybe a new era that's not all man. Mosquito.
Well, they're trying for it, and they keep trying for it. We keep reaching for that high of Battlestar Galactica, which at its time was sort of it was one of the great shows on TV.
Yeah,
I don't know that I'd call 12 Monkeys one of the great shows on TV yet, but it's a pretty solid start. Yeah, it's a solid opener. So, all right, well, that about wraps it up for us this week, and we hope to see you in the store. And until next time,
Yo-Jo!
And that'll wrap it up for us this week. As always, you can drop us email with topic suggestions, things you want us to hear about, or just comments on the podcast at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter at roguesgallery. Check us out on Facebook. Check out our website at www.roguesgallerytx.com. And we'll see you in the store, and you can listen to us again next week.